Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. Earlier this month, a plaque that marked the burial place of indigenous children who died at the Albuquerque Indian School went missing. At the same time, Native American boarding schools have been in the international news after forensic technology revealed over 1,000 previously unknown graves of Native American children throughout the U.S. and Canada. This morning, we'll be discussing the legacy of these so-called Indian schools by looking into their racist history, the physical harm that they did to children, as well as their intended purpose of assimilating Native Americans by eliminating their languages and cultures. We will also explore how New Mexico's indigenous tribes have repurposed some of the sites to fulfill positive roles in their community's futures, and discuss how Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland's Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative might play a role in exposing the truth about what happened at these institutions. And we want to hear from you. Did you or a family member attend one of New Mexico's Native American boarding schools? What stories, good or bad, would you like to share? And how do you think we should memorialize the children who died at these schools far from their families and homes? Email us at letstalk@kunm.org or call in live 505-277-5866. My first guest is Jolene Holgate, the Training and Education Director for the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women. Good morning, Jolene. Thanks for joining us. So,
good morning, Ty.
And could you tell me about the graves at Albuquerque's 4-H Park? How many are there, and what do we know about them?
So the graves are located at 4-H Park, where approximately 120 indigenous children who are Navajo, Zuni, and Apache were buried there that attended Albuquerque Indian School. That's the site.
So do we know anything about the names of these children or their stories at this point?
At this point, no. According to some of the stories that we've heard from community members, also from the school itself, the record keeping of the children who were buried there were lost in a fire several years ago. However, there is speculation around an anthropological report that was done by UNM some years back on the site. However, that report's not public, so we're not quite sure what kind of records they may have or what information they could have.
So that's currently in the archives at UNM, but nobody has seen it since it was made. Is that right?
Right. And the reason why it comes up is because community members are made aware of it years ago. And they were just kind of wondering, where is it at? You know, if it was such an important report, why is it not public?
Right. So even though we don't know the names of these children or their specific stories, are there things that we can infer about their experience at the Albuquerque Indian Boarding School?
Yeah, I think it would be appropriate to assume that their experiences there, you know, more than likely was not a good one. These were Native children taken from their homes, taken from their parents, taken from their ways of life that they grew up in and placed into these institutions that are very foreign to Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. To be, you know, assimilated into these schools required the cutting of their hair, telling them not to speak their language, and just the complete erasure of their identities once they get there. I would also think that they felt very sad, that there was a lot of sorrow and grief in leaving their families. And although, you know, folks may assume that schools are there to not only better education, but better a person, that wasn't the case for Indigenous children. A lot of the times there were abuse, there was violence, there was sexual abuse happening to these children who didn't have any type of agency over any part of their lives at that very, very pivotal point of their livelihood as children. Mm-hmm.
So as I mentioned, the plaque that once marked this site, it has gone missing. How is that a disturbing development for you?
It's very disheartening because the plaque was the commemoration of the lives that were there. We understand the other plaque is still at the park. However, just the removal of it itself is just very indicative of how intentional it is to erase the children that are there, to erase the Indigenous history within Albuquerque, especially with all of the things taking place right now in terms of residential schools in Canada and other boarding schools in the United States that are looking into these burial sites. For someone to take that plaque brings up a lot of emotions of anger, mm-hmm. of sadness. I think a lot of folks also weren't very surprised, sadly. And excuse me. And I think with the removal of the plaque, it really initiated some more, you know, like healing action within our communities. And I think those are just some of the feelings that we're having. It's mixed emotions, but also bringing us forward in a very prayerful way.
Right. And as you mentioned, healing actions, the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women, along with some other organizations, held a healing event at the site of these graves this past weekend or nearby. Could you tell me about that event?
Yeah, this was a community-organized event, which was led by amazing organizers from different organizations. The Coalition was there in support to provide whatever it is that we could. We had Fight for Our Lives Albuquerque out there, Mutual Aid Albuquerque, as well as youth and elders that came together in the planning. It was done in a very intentional and prayerful way to commemorate these children, because we know with the removal of the plaque, folks were grieving. And this event centered our children. Some of the activities that took place during this event included youth being able to, do art projects. They were able to do some art, science kits as well. There were some physical activities that they could do, like tug of war, or just being able to run around in these spaces because that's their space. The space was specifically for them to really express themselves. But we also had some jingle dress dancers there who adopt that way from our northern relatives. The jingle dress is a healing dress, and hearing the songs and the prayers was to really just honor the children that we lost who are buried there, but also to honor the children that are here today.
And how did you personally feel when you were there at the event?
There were a lot of emotions, I think, for me. One, from the outset, seeing all the community come together, all our Indigenous relatives and allies come together. It was a really good feeling. It was good to be back in community again. At the same time, there were also feelings of grief and sorrow, feelings of even helplessness, you know, like what's going to happen next? You know, what kind of impact will this make? You know, how much louder do we need to be? But along with those feelings, understanding that we have to channel that energy into finding solution-based pathways to call for justice.
Right. I have a call from Glenn in Jemez Springs. Good morning, Glenn. What would you like to add to the conversation today?
Yeah, 5 years ago, my wife and I went with a peace delegation, Christian peacemaker teams, to Canada. A couple hours east of Kenora, Canada, to a band of the Anishinaabe, Ojibwe, we say, tribe. And they had many, like 100 from their community taken away to residential schools. And I have a picture of this huge cement memorial, like 6 feet by 10 feet. Half of it had the names of at least 100 who were taken away. The other half of those who never returned and were assumed to have died. And this was such an emotional thing. We listened to Rising Dawn, a woman quite elderly who had been one of those, give her painful talk. And then a man also. Regrettably, that community even had another hit. The lumber community, for 50 years, coming in and taking their trees, had polluted their waters, their beautiful lakes around their territory with mercury. And so this community just struggling, they had to have water brought into them. So the whole story of the residential schools is something that sticks with my wife and me. She has, by the way, an hour-long PowerPoint on this experience, if anybody would care to see that. She works, by the way, with BIA in Albuquerque now and has worked with the Jemez Pueblo BIE school for 12 years. And this is kind of near and dear to us as immigrants from way back who saw this genocide by white people in our own country.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Glenn. Jolene, Glenn mentioned a memorial. How do you think it is best for us to mark and memorialize the children at this cemetery here in Albuquerque?
That's definitely hard to answer because memorializing a grave is not justice. Mm-hmm. What justice looks like is having community at the table, our Indigenous relatives at the table, to start those discussions with the city of Albuquerque to determine what those next steps are. Tribal nations should also be at the table to talk about what it is that they want to do, to give agency to these different Indigenous stakeholders who want their children either to come home or, you know, based on their own traditions, you know, how would they honor that? I think putting up another plaque or a monument or whatever is not justice. Mm-hmm. And that's not what it looks like for Indigenous folks here within this community. So we would call on community to really push for accountability from the city to initiate some of those conversations. I know they have reached out to tribal leaders, but we would like to see elders, we'd like to see youth, we'd like to see some of these community organizing organizations as stakeholders too. Here in, you know, Albuquerque, which is the ancestral land of the Tiwa peoples, it's really important that these next steps are done in a very intentional way.
Certainly. And what do you think are some things that we can do going forward? What would you like to see? What sort of priorities should we have as we look at moving forward using the looking back at the mistakes that were made and trying to take us into the future?
Well, I think first and foremost, the community here or even just the state as a whole has to face those truths and have these intentional conversations. To take action and to look into what those system changes look like. We call for accountability of the city, the state, as well as our federal partners. We understand that Congresswoman Deb Haaland, who's a relative from Laguna, has created a boarding school investigation initiative. Mm-hmm. This information has been passed along, so we're hoping for action on that end to also happen. When we think about boarding school survivors as well, they need support. They have the same PTSD levels as combat veterans just because of all of what they have endured. Our elders who survived the boarding school, or even folks who are baby boomers, or even Gen X folks. And I use those just to illustrate the generational, the generational gap between the experiences, because the last boarding school didn't close until the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And although some of the experiences may not have been as harsh, it's that legacy that has left intergenerational trauma in terms of our people. So we need healing support for our survivors of boarding school, and to have those types of discussions, and also, you know, have these issues talked about within our families, within our communities. What is that true history of Albuquerque? What's the true history of New Mexico? If we are to move forward, all pieces of these areas we live in have to be acknowledged, and the first peoples here have to be honored. Their stories have to be prioritized to right the wrongs that have, you know, history has left. I would also say that some of the changes that need to be made are some of the impacts of the education system. Mm-hmm. If we think about the youth whose hair was cut in their classroom in 2018, that is so indicative of us to do better. As I mentioned before, back then when children would come to the boarding school, the first thing they would do is cut their hair. Right. And to see that happen, you know, just a couple of years ago here in Albuquerque, it's incredibly disappointing. You know, where's the uproar? Where's the call to justice? You know, so there's just so many things that we need to do within the systems where we can definitely do better. And more importantly, we need to also look at the impacts on our Native youth. What are some of those system changes that can support them? And I know that's going to be talked about a little bit here later, but we need to support our Native youth.
Certainly. And we do need to go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are talking about the history of New Mexico's Indian boarding schools, and we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 505-277-5866. We'll be back in a moment.
Support comes from REDW, an Albuquerque-based and locally owned CPA and advisory firm dedicated to serving the needs of New Mexico businesses and individuals since 1953. Complete details about services at redw.com.
Support comes from Il Vicino Restaurants in Albuquerque and Santa Fe, open for indoor and patio dining, Sunday through Thursday, 11 till 9, Fridays and Saturdays, 11 till 10. Dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service available. IlVicino.com.
Last year marked Beethoven's 250th birthday, and celebrations have included a lot of new music inspired by his work. Coming up, the world premiere of a piece by Anna Klein. It's new music inspired by Beethoven from a recent concert in Australia on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. I am speaking with Jolene Holgate about the unmarked graves located near the former site of the Albuquerque Indian School. And I want to hear your thoughts on how this site should be treated. Give us a call at 277-5866 and tell us your thoughts. And Jolene, as you mentioned, on Tuesday, the Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, announced an initiative that would, and I'm quoting here, search federal boarding schools for possible burial sites of Native American children, hundreds of thousands of whom were forcibly taken from their communities to be culturally assimilated in the schools for more than a century. How do you hope that this initiative will help improve the lives of Native American children today?
I think for one, having a great leader like Deb Haaland, an Indigenous leader, the first in her capacity, but also in terms of the Interior Department, but also the first to just give recognition to the issues that are impacting Indigenous communities, to be very intentional about creating this investigative unit for boarding schools, I think is really going to illustrate to our Native youth that someone does care. Mm-hmm. You know, it may have taken one of our own to be in this position to bring light to this issue, But I think that also instills hope, not just for our Native youth, but also for our communities whose voices have been silenced. And I feel like how it would be very impactful is, you know, if this could be, you know, a trickle,
like a trickle that turns to a flood?
Yeah, where some of these changes in the systems are going to happen, I'm hoping. And I think if our youth do see that, I think it would instill more hope with them in terms of how they're being cared for within the education system, how the communities use them, and also instilling within their spirits how important they are and how they are loved, and that there are people who are going to the front lines for them, and they need to see that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to bring in another guest now, Dr. John Graham, a professor of history at the Missouri State University and the author of the book Education at the Edge of Empire, Negotiating Pueblo Identity in New Mexico's Indian Boarding Schools. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
And thank you so much for joining us. I wonder if you could kind of take us through a capsule version of the history of these boarding schools here in New Mexico and how they evolved over time.
Sure. So around the end of the 19th century, the federal government makes a decision to basically take over the bulk of Indian education for itself. It had been supporting religious organizations doing this job for them, but begins to take over the process for itself. And part of this process is it builds a couple of dozen off-reservation boarding schools that sit at the top of this system of hundreds of government schools that feed into them. And two of those off-reservation boarding schools are built in Santa Fe and in Albuquerque. And I think it's really important to acknowledge what I think Glenn, one of the callers, said earlier. He used the word genocide. I think we need to be comfortable using that word in relation to these schools. The purpose of these schools was to destroy indigeneity. Mm-hmm. One of the really important leaders in the boarding school movement, Richard Pratt, actually his phrase is "kill the Indian, save the man."
Right.
So you have this sense in which white Americans have become convinced through their scientific knowledge at the time that indigenous peoples cannot survive. They have to be saved from themselves. And that is actually the purpose of these schools. It is genocidal to destroy Indianness, not only for the sake of saving Indians from themselves, but also, quite frankly, to have better access to indigenous lands and to destroy indigenous political power. So that's sort of what the purpose of the schools as they opened in the late 19th century. And that really, that purpose doesn't really get challenged, honestly, until around 1928, when the government releases something called the Merriam Report. And in light of the Merriam Report, reformers begin to sort of think through what are these schools supposed to accomplish? Is there inherent value in indigeneity? And I don't want to give too rosy a picture because the reform movements themselves are still very ethnocentric. They certainly are still have the purpose of trying assimilate Native youth into the American culture. They're not trying to preserve indigenous language and culture. But in some ways, post-World War II is sort of a different story when it comes to how severe the assimilative model is. But it's still there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why so many indigenous tribal nations have begun to have their own efforts at education, building their own schools, at times taking over these boarding schools, because ultimately, even if the model is less severe, there still was not a model predicated on preservation of tribal traditions and language and culture.
And here in New Mexico, I understand that there was kind of a different evolution over time than we saw at places like the Carlisle Industrial Boarding School and that sort of thing. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, one of the things I argue in my book is that there are several sort of local realities that make the experience at Santa Fe and Albuquerque Indian School somewhat different for Pueblo students than it might have been for students at these other schools, which isn't to downplay either the intentions of the school, sort of downplay the severity of the experiences that could be had there. But at the same time, there are several local factors that, I think allow Pueblo communities and Pueblo students to push back and to challenge the power of these schools in ways that maybe other tribal nations don't get those opportunities. One is, for a very long time, there's sort of this ambiguous legal status that Pueblos enjoy. Mexico, when it still controlled what we call the Southwest now, it had just kind of artificially declared the Pueblos to be citizens. They were Mexican citizens now. They weren't seen as indigenous legally anymore. And so when the U.S. Conquers steals the Southwest, the treaty that ends that war says that all Mexican citizens should have the opportunity to become American citizens, and their land rights should be respected. And so legally, this creates a problem because from the U.S. perspective, from federal law's perspective, all indigenous peoples are considered wards of the state during this late 19th century period. But the Pueblos are also Mexican citizens. Are they indigenous? Are they citizens? So this ambiguity gives them some wiggle room that I think helps quite a bit. You also have the fact that the Pueblos, that by the time they encounter the schools, the Pueblos already have generations of experience with colonial powers. This is not their first time to experience an invasion by outsiders mm-hmm. trying to destroy their way of life. You also have the fact that in New Mexico, you have a strong Catholic presence, not only through the churches, but through the schools. And these Catholic schools and priests actually become a competition, actually become a challenge to the federal power. And that gives the Pueblos opportunities to kind of play both sides off each other in some ways that maybe other tribal nations don't have that opportunity. So, again, none of that is to downplay what the schools wanted to accomplish. Mm-hmm. Nor is it to downplay the very destructive nature of what they were able to accomplish. But it is to say that I think the other part of that story is making sure we're giving credit, not only in this story to the Pueblo nations, but giving credit to other students and other tribal communities that one of the reasons, maybe the main reason the schools fail is because indigenous people do push back. They do fight for their children. They do everything in their power to oppose this, mm-hmm. even when that power is limited. And that should be part of the story, too.
I have an email from John Gahate, the museum cultural educator at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center. He says that as a descendant of a student who was taken to the Carlisle Industrial Indian School as an educator and most importantly as a member of one of New Mexico's Pueblo communities, he wants to weigh in on this. He says certainly there were many horrific and traumatic stories in these experiences people had at the Indian schools, and he wants to honor those experiences but also offer a slightly differing paradigm for understanding. He says that eventually those students who suffered and endured their boarding schools after generations advanced their education, became eligible to acquire advanced degrees and professional credits. And now many Native Americans now achieve these same things, contributing to their communities, the state and the country and the global community. The challenge for us as Native Americans is to value the lives of all Native students who endured the Indian boarding school mentality. Remember, they paved the way for us as Native Americans to use the tools of education, which were forced on them. And now they use those tools to prepare and structure their own futures with their own narratives, guided by their own core values, and pave the way for future generations. He sees this as perpetuating their voices because of this resilience and perseverance. It is a testament to the fact that the Indian schools failed to kill the Indian. And I want to go to Jolene. Jolene, do you have any thoughts on John's perspective on this issue?
Yeah, I think he's right in how we utilize terminology. To be very accurate with history, especially in the state of New Mexico or even just nationally, it's really important to acknowledge the genocidal policies that were put in place to erase indigenous livelihood, to erase, our children. These boarding schools were very intentional in doing that. But also when our babies succumbed to those abuses and were ultimately murdered by this system, it was intentional that they didn't let their families know. Mm-hmm. It was intentional that they did not mark the graves as they would any other person who would be buried, with a name, with a date, with proper communication to the families that they lost their loved one. That didn't happen. And that's just very indicative of the system itself. And I think it's also really important, especially when we think about boarding schools, as it relates to root causes of violence within tribal communities. A lot of our survivors who were in boarding schools ultimately also become very vulnerable to some of the social issues that are plaguing their communities, whether that's, you know, drug and alcohol mm-hmm. dependency, or suicidal ideation, even to the missing and murdered crisis. These all have to do with intergenerational trauma that comes from this system. Mm-hmm. When we look at the model of the United States right now, especially when it was first implemented, you had wealthy white male landowners with enslaved folks, while also trying to deal with the so-called Indian problem. Our coalition, the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women, recognized that this was the first power and control model. If you talk with any advocate who works with domestic or sexual violence survivors, they'll tell you a little bit about that power and control model. And that comes from the larger scale of the system itself. The policies that were put in place, whether that was systemic or institutional racism, it was to target Black and Indigenous folks. It was intentional in how they were treating Indigenous people. So yes, I would agree. It is the intentional erasure of Indigenous people, their indigeneity, through these genocidal actions.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Jolene. John, I'd like to go back to you. And just as you mentioned, the Pueblos here in New Mexico had a lot of influence over the development of the schools. But they were, as Jolene says, racist in their intention and throughout their existence. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, yes. So any alleviation that the Pueblos are able to bring to the experience of these schools, it is something that's imposed on the schools. Like that, the school's desire is to de-Indianize these students. In other words, I'm not saying that the personnel at these schools were kinder or gentler than their cohorts elsewhere. It's just the Pueblos were able to, I think, influence the situation more than perhaps some tribal nations were, right? And this is the hard balance in talking about the schools. Although on the one hand, we will acknowledge what was said in the email, right? Native resilience. This is part of the story. They did not work. And on the other hand, what Jolene mentions is really important, in that even though the schools don't work, they fail, they do a hell of a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. Not only intergenerational trauma, we're still looking at severe uphill battles for linguistic and cultural revitalization. In other words, the boarding schools are not a neat chapter of history we can kind of close and say, well, that was a mistake, that was unfortunate. It is an ongoing reality that we need to deal with.
And is understanding the history part of that, like understanding all the nuances of that history?
All right. I'm sorry, one more time?
I'm sorry. Just is understanding all the nuances of the history and how things may have been different here part of that ongoing issue that we're dealing with?
It absolutely is. One of the things that I think all the scholarship on boarding schools has taught us is that really, although we can talk in sort of general terms about what the schools were like, that each boarding school and each tribal nation's relation to those schools is a unique story, right? And so we don't want to say there's this sort of generic solution that will solve all of the legacies of these schools for all communities at the same time. We need to make the local histories available so that the local stakeholders can understand better the impact of the schools on their communities, and they can then come up with better solutions.
Okay, well, thank you Dr. John Graham. It is time for a quick break. You are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman, and we are discussing the legacy of New Mexico's Indian boarding schools. How do you think we should talk about these institutions? Call us at 277-5866.
From baking cakes and making soap and creating items to wear, young natives are jumping into the business world. They're learning the ropes on how to attract and retain customers while telling their cultural story. Join us for the next Native America Calling, where we'll visit with some young business leaders and hear their secrets to success.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Donations come in many forms, a sustaining membership, a one-time gift, even that extra vehicle you no longer need. Donating a vehicle is a great way to support KUNM. It's easy. Pickup is free, you get a tax deduction, a KUNM membership, and your vehicle could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Give us a call today to learn more about donating your vehicle. Call 888-KUNM-CAR, that's 888-586-6227. And thanks for your support.
And welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are discussing the New Mexico Indian boarding schools, and we want to hear your thoughts. You can still call in at 277-5866. Now, I'd like to welcome to the show Mike Canfield. He is the CEO of the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center and the Indian Pueblo Federal Development Corporation. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Ty. Good morning, John. Good morning, Jolene. Nice to be with you all this morning.
And thank you for joining us. Before we get on to some of the questions I have for you, Mike, we do have a call from Jim in Albuquerque. Good morning, Jim. What would you like to talk to us about today?
Hi. I live in the neighborhood, and I've done some work at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, some volunteer work, and so I'm familiar with that park, and I'm also on a neighborhood association board. And regarding that park there, I think as a way to move forward, there's a couple of things that need to be done. I think the neighborhood associations need to be approached, and I think they would be in support of putting a more suitable memorial there. And then the other thing is, there's a statue of a conquistador helmet there in that park, which is kind of adjacent to the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center and certainly in close proximity to the old boarding school there. So I think that needs to be removed, and a new memorial needs to be put in place, and perhaps even renaming that park. So I think those will be actions that need to be happening.
Well, thank you for your thoughts this morning, Jim. Mike, you're the CEO of the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center. Do you have any thoughts as to the suggestions Jim has made?
Sure. The park is part of the Indian school property that we didn't get. Okay, our tribal leaders petitioned to get some of this land back to us in the form of ownership and trust, and so we haven't had a lot of involvement over there. I'm also work with the neighborhood committee, and we knew that part, that plaque had been stolen, I think it was back in 2019. Mm. It was a brass plaque, and they were stolen all over town. The city never stepped up to replace it, and it's now a good time to have that discussion to say, how should we replace it? And to get the community involved, I think is really good. So even though it was bad that somebody stole that plaque, I think it was probably for the money. Mm-hmm. Personally, but it does bring this to light, along with Deb Holland's initiative, that we might do a better job in paying respect for those individuals that are there and some of the history of the Indian school.
What would be your ideal circumstance resulting from the attention being paid to this grave site? What do you think that we should take away from the experience of those children?
Well, first off, I think learning, I think we all need to learn, and we talked about history, and we talked about, so far in the program, you talked about history and accuracy and truth and so forth. And I think that, understanding, trying to learn the truth, of what the Albuquerque Indian School was all about, because we can't impute the travesties of other boarding schools and just assume that they absolutely happened here at the Albuquerque Indian School, because I don't think a lot of them did. I think John talked about the influence of the Pueblo influence on Albuquerque Indian School, and I know about that. My grandmother was one of the individuals from Laguna that was that attended the Carlisle School, and she came back and taught school at Zuni and taught school at Laguna, and then ended up back at the Indian School and helped students learn English. And she wasn't a racist. And so there was a huge Pueblo influence on the Albuquerque Indian School. And I know that we've committed to do something to commemorate the Albuquerque Indian School on our property when we're doing the development across the street. We've also had a Albuquerque Indian School exhibit that Dr. Ted Hohola helped us with. He's a resident expert on the Albuquerque Indian School, and I would suggest you reach out to him because he did a lot of research on exactly what was going on at the Albuquerque Indian School. And we had a reunion here of students from the Albuquerque Indian School, and it wasn't a somber occasion. You know, they came together, and you know, many of them met their spouses there, and so certain things came out of that. I'm kind of moving away from the grave situation, but I think it's important to understand the accuracy of history here in Albuquerque. And then, you know, certainly by bringing it up, talking about it, the things that weren't positive about any of those things need to be, we need to get through that and heal from that. My family is an example of assimilation, because my grandmother went there, she came back, she married a non-native. My parents in that generation married non-natives, and I married a non-native. And so exactly what they wanted to have happen, and my daughter is no longer considered a Native American. We went to the Heard Museum, and I took my daughters there, and we cried at that exhibit, not from the travesty. It was more from that we understand now what happened. We are who we are. We loved our parents. I loved my grandfather. I loved my mother. They were good people. It wasn't their fault. But the fact that there was an attack on the culture, and I think that's really the victim here. And I think that the cultural center is an answer to that. And if I could, I'll let you speak. But I'd like to talk about what the Pueblo leaders have done to overcome that, you know, that attack on our culture. And they got together back in the 60s and said, we need a place where we can celebrate our culture, where we can help perpetuate the Pueblo culture. And 19 Pueblo leaders petitioned the federal government and said, give us some of that land back. And we want to create a cultural center that's ours, that we feel comfortable coming to, and that we feel comfortable in celebrating our culture, and more importantly, sharing and educating our culture with the rest of the world. That's how the cultural center started. And we're very proud of the fact that we're accomplishing that by spreading the word about our culture throughout the world, through the internet, through visitation here and so forth. So that's a start, because now that property that was once, you may say was, some may say was once an assault on our culture. And now we've taken control and reversed that, and we are perpetuating our culture. We also have education here. We brought NACA, the Native American Community Academy. We saved the last standing building of the Albuquerque Indian School and renovated that for them. And so now education's back on the property, but in our terms, not in the federal government's terms. So I think this is a great example of property of learning from what happened, respecting all that happened, and understanding and trying to figure out exactly the truth of what happened, but moving forward and understanding how we can promote and save our culture, save our language, and the things that are very, and the traditions that are very important to us as Pueblo people.
And I would like to point out that the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center is on the land that the Albuquerque Indian School occupied, but now it is owned by the 19 Pueblos. Am I accurate about there?
That is correct. We have almost all of it under our control. There are still some areas, I think, where the Lowe's is and the McDonald's and some of the other areas, the 4-H behind us, that park, for example, was once property of the Albuquerque Indian School. We're probably between 75 and 80 acres now through five different transfers from the federal government that we petitioned to give them back to us for either economic development reasons or for our cultural education reasons. The federal government's been great. The city of Albuquerque has been totally supportive. Every mayor I've dealt with has written a letter of support saying, yes, give the federal land to the Pueblos, mm-hmm. even though the city doesn't get taxes from us because we tax ourselves. All the mayors that I've worked with have been totally supportive of that transition of ownership to us so we can tell our story and our voices about our culture and about our history.
And I'd like to, you know, with that in mind, welcome onto the show Regis Pecos. He is the co-founder and co-director of the Leadership Institute at the Santa Fe Indian School, as well as the former governor of Cochiti Pueblo. Thank you so much for joining us today, Governor.
Good morning. Thank you.
And I would like to point out that much like the Albuquerque Indian School, the land that was occupied by the federal government Santa Fe Indian School is now also owned by the Pueblos. Is that correct, Regis?
Yes, it is. And I want to thank you, Mike, for the beautiful articulation of the history of the Albuquerque Indian School and the way that your personalization of the impact of the policies that began in 1890 with that first Indian education policy unveiled to have been based upon a more humane approach. By that time, the government defining us, our forefathers, our ancestors, to be the Indian problem. And as many have said, the systems and the structures that were built purposefully on a mantra that the effort was to kill language and culture, and taking children from their language and culture and removing them to boarding schools was part of that process. And those systems and structures built on that kind of intentionality, Mike, it's a very painful history that few people know, but the personalization of yours to underscore that those systems and structures that were built in that time using children did exactly what, accomplished exactly what it was intended to. And it's a beautiful and courageous story that you share about the completion of that process that today the Santa Fe Indian School is a continuum of that vision and of that wisdom of Pueblo leaders to push back and disrupt that process that over time has simply been re-imaged in multiple ways, but the intentionality of killing language and culture and a way of life and prohibiting the practice of our religion, even as this country was founded on the free exercise of religion, continues in many different forms. And unfortunately, education is a very significant part of that reimaging. You know, with the recent public designee for the public education of New Mexico under the Martinez administration, you know, his point that the core values of education are built upon the principles of manifest destiny. And the Pueblo leadership responded how offensive that was, because that very principle and process is a continuation of your personalized story of boarding schools. But I also appreciate that across the country and here in New Mexico, that as you point out, there are multiple differing experiences, devastation on one extreme, but over time, the influence of Pueblos and leadership and other tribal leaders from this state want to create as best as they could with an imposed system and structure, in this case, the Albuquerque Boarding School, the Santa Fe Indian Boarding School, really created some very positive outcomes of relationships that continue generationally to this day. So on one extreme, devastation, as was ironically not the most humane way to deal with children. Hopi elders who fought federal agents from removing children, one were in prison on Alcatraz. And you go all the way to the other end of the extreme as you share what has transformed on the previous Albuquerque Indian School campus, what that was once known as a warehouse of children, nobody wanted, and transformed that continuum into one of the most prominent tribally controlled schools in this nation, the Santa Fe Indian School. And in a similar way, tribal leaders, Pueblo governors petitioning the federal government that as part of this kind of response to the reckoning of the past and the devastation of their policies intentionally conceived to do its purpose in one killing language and culture and then making us invisible. And these schools once destined to be that now have become places of survival that ironically, these places that were supposed to make us invisible has made us prominent nationally to become one of the first schools in the nation to ever receive the President's Award of Excellence in Education, not on the federal government's term, not on assimilation policies, but defined by core values to sustain and make it part of our cultural survival, making language, culture, history, art, music at the heart different than the indictment recently in 2018 of the public education system to do just the very opposite. And in the 1928 Merriam Report, there is a very classic, profound statement that talks about what we need is a change of mind. And that 1928 Merriam Report was the first research document to, one, reflect on the devastation caused in the 40-year period from the first unveiling of the Indian Education Policy. And the 1928 Merriam Report, one by the Brookings Institution and funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, one found the devastation caused by boarding schools and the larger implementation of policies to separate us from our land that led to the 1934 Howard Wheeler Act that included...
We are coming up to the end of the show, but I do want to thank you so much for your contributions today, as well as thank you to our callers, our guests, Julian Holgate, John Graham, Mike Canfield, Regis Pecos. If you missed part of this show, you can stream it online or subscribe to our podcast. You can find that wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Join us next week for Let's Talk New Mexico. We're talking about childcare and expanded state subsidies that will help more people pay for that essential service. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Robert Maldonado screened your calls. Megan Kamrick produced the show, and I'm Ty Bannerman. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. Thank you.